Dylan, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks for having me, Pete.
Glad you could make it here. Congratulations on funding your project, your Kickstarter project.
Thank you, man. It's been a long couple of months. It's been good to get it done, I can tell you that.
Yeah. Well, I really want to hear about it. First, though, I'd like to just ask you a few kind of general questions. First, how did you get your start in photography?
Oh, that's a long story. Photography for me, I mean, I'd like to say I've been doing it since I was a kid. And I mean, we've all had cameras since we were kids, but photography really sort of started to become something for me when I was about 18 years old and I started traveling. And I sort of wanted to be able to bring back those memories and sort of have them stand on their own for other people so that I could show it to them. And that sort of turned into me being in Korea and working with the local expat magazines here. They started to bring me in to do a few different things, and I got a taste for what it was like to, although a very small taste, of what it was like to work in the photography industry, and it sort of put its hooks in me, and I decided that I was going to work towards doing it full-time.
And how did you choose to come to Korea?
Korea for me was, I was a Korean language major, so it sort of seemed the natural step. I mean, there's quite a few Koreans in Korea. It's a great place to practice the language. So that's sort of how I ended up here. And then I finished school and just sort of never left and took a job teaching English, as that was the other half of my degree. And just spiraled from there.
And then how did you make the transition from being an English teacher to a full-time photographer?
I think I'd like to be able to tell you a long story, but it's more just sort of quit. One day I just sort of said to myself, look, you know, you've been working two full-time jobs for this long now, working with the local magazines, and then getting a little bit of corporate stuff here and there, which led to sort of meeting more and more people who needed different services and sort of gradually building my portfolio and being able to show people what I was doing on its own two legs rather than sort of doing it around my my teaching. And so I decided I was just going to take 6 months off, go traveling, get my head in the place where it needed to be, and then put myself out there and said, hey, look, I'm a photographer. Do you want to hire me? And that's sort of where it came from, you know?
How did you get that first job with the foreign magazines, the English magazines in Korea? How did you start working with them? Did you pitch stories to them, or did they contact you?
At that point, there were three local magazines here, and myself and another good friend of mine, Sean Parker, who was at the time also just sort of getting into photography, and we were running these little strobist meetups and things at that point, and we're also running the Seoul Photography Club. We both, myself, Sean, and actually Aaron Brown, another good friend of mine, all three of us just said, well, why don't we give this a try? It seems like they need better photography than they have. So let's just throw ourselves out there and say, hey, we do this and we'd be up for anything. We'd love to learn a little bit more and provide you guys with some high-quality images. And they turned around and said, well, yeah, that's great. I mean, we can't really pay you, and we were more in it for the experience anyway, so that's sort of where it started, just sort of asking them, hey, can we work for you?
And then how about that point when you actually started to make money with your photography, like let's say your commercial work, like how did the work with the magazines build into some gigs that mm-hmm, got you mm-hmm. paid?
I think, you know, editorial photography, the great thing about it is the varied people you get to work with. One day you'll be shooting in a restaurant working with a chef. The next day you'll be, you know, meeting the head of a company and working with him to do a portrait of him. The next day, you know, you might be doing a travel feature or something on a certain district in your city or something like that. And so you get to meet a lot of people along the way. And I think, you know, the best way to build your network and to be able to turn this into a money-making opportunity is to forget about making money and sort of build those relationships with the people you do work with, even when you're doing it for free, or if you're doing it for free, to build those relationships and keep them down the line, because those people will come back to you when they need something outside of, you know, what the magazine is doing or something like that.
Do you do anything to stay in touch with those people? Like, do you, you know, send out an email every month, or, you know, do any type of marketing to keep in contact with those people? Or are they just people you worked with and then, you know, later on down the line, they just contact you out of the blue?
You know, in the beginning, I did a lot of, you know, I'd grab people's business cards and I'd send them. I don't know. I still do thank people for, you know, for the time they give me at each place where I go to talk to them. But I used to send out a lot more sort of, hey, how's things going? Just wondering if you need any services or anything like that. Please give me a call if you do. I used to send out a lot more of that, but as business got a little bit better, it's been more of a case of those people, you know, it sort of swings around and more people come back to contacting you rather than you having to sort of make that hustle. Not to say that you don't make the hustle, but it's mm-hmm. it becomes more of a 50-50 rather than an, you know, 80-20 sort of relationship.
Yeah. And then, so how about now? Your core business, you're doing portrait photography, wedding photography, engagement, events, commercial, adoptions, food and beverage. Am I missing anything?
I resent wedding photography. I don't do that. No, only for very close friends, I'll sometimes, you know, do a few if they just need somebody for a dinner or something like that. But no, I don't take wedding. No.
Why is that?
It's too much stress for me. Honestly, I think that, mm-hmm. you know, it's one day of somebody's life, and there are people who do it better than I could ever do. So letting them do it and sort of me stepping back from that is probably good for everybody involved.
One of the things you hear a lot of pro photographers say, or advice that mm-hmm. they give, is to be successful, you have to specialize in one field and get really good at that one thing. Mm-hmm. How do you stay focused and competitive when you're working in so many different areas or fields?
You know, I think that being specialized means that you get very, very, very good at one thing, obviously, and you're able to sort of be the best in your field. But working in the area that I work in Seoul, there's not a lot of competition around in terms of people who specialize in one specific thing. There's not a lot of people doing it full time. So for us to specialize in one mm-hmm. thing would limit the amount of work that you're able to do. So I think being reasonably good at four or five different things is sort of the core of doing business in Seoul at this time. I mean, in the future, it might turn into something where we do have to start specializing and just, you know, there's a photographer for this and a photographer for that. And at that point, you know, it's definitely something that we'll have to reconsider, myself and the other couple of people who are working here full time. But in terms of keeping myself focused, I take every day as it comes, every job as it comes. And I find that if my heart's not in something, and this is probably going back to wedding stuff as well, if my heart's not in something, I mm-hmm. won't do a very good job of it. If my heart is in it, I'll find a way to do a good job of it. And I think that's maybe how I keep myself focused, is just being really, really dedicated to the people I'm working with, to the job that I'm doing. And if I don't feel it, I generally won't take the job if I have a sort of a bad gut feeling about it. Does that mm-hmm. sort of answer the question?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yes. So how do you know then, where to put your energy? You said you focus on what your passion mm-hmm. is in. Is there anything in particular, like what are some of the areas that you're more passionate about, say, or any of the projects that you're working on lately?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think, you know, a good portion of my core business is actually working with adoptive families. And I have a lot of passion in that. I think that, you know, children are the future, and to be able to give a child memories of just how their life was at that particular time, and, you know, just a few smiles that they'll be able to look back on in the future and say, well, look, I actually, you know, I had a great time here as well. I think that's a pretty powerful thing. So, you know, putting my energy into that sort of gives them something to look back on in the future. And I think that keeps me going with that sort of work. But personally, you know, if I'm going out to pick up my camera just to do something that I really want to do, I'm generally going to be looking for something where the world is in flux. It's changing. The old is going away. The new is coming in. I find that really, really interesting. And you'll see a lot of it in Seoul where, you know, entire districts get leveled to make way for new high-rise apartments. And, you know, the people who were or still are living in that area are basically displaced or pushed into a little corner. And I think that's where you find some really interesting stories to look at.
One of your personal projects that you worked on was with the folk artists.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, does that have anything to do with, you know, the world being in flux, or maybe like the folk art or music is kind of being lost? Is that a reason why you picked up that project or did that?
Yeah, I think for me, there's a little bit of that in it. I find the way that the folk artists in Korea, the people who are sort of doing things the traditional Korean way, making instruments, playing music, making different foods and drinks and things like that in the traditional way, I find them really fascinating because Korea is, for those of you who don't live here, it's a nation that's hell-bent on developing at all costs. And it really has been for the past 30 or 40 years. I mean, they called it the Miracle on the Hun for a reason. Seoul went from farmland to high-rise apartments and the 11th biggest economy in the world pretty much overnight. And that's left a lot of people behind. It's also given the people who went with that momentum a bit of a mentality where they don't really care too much for the things that they leave behind. Things change very rapidly here. I heard one person actually suggest that, you know, you can walk to work in the morning, grab a coffee, and as you walk home, the coffee shop will then be a barbecue house because, things change that rapidly here, you know?
Yeah.
And so for me, like watching these people do work with their hands, people who haven't embraced that modern career, people who you still have to call on a landline, you know, and make an appointment and show up for it. There is no changing because they don't have a way to contact them after they leave home. You know, people like that really fascinate me because it is part of the old world again. That flux, that disappearing sort of culture that I find so fascinating. So, yeah, I sort of sought those people out and tried to make as close an approximation of perhaps what their job would have looked like years ago. Through using modern tools. So that doesn't really make sense. So to say that the photograph should have nothing modern in it, but I would be using modern tools to create that that particular style.
Where did you get the idea for that project? Do you have any sort of system or thing that you do to... I saw somewhere you wrote that you jot down ideas in a notebook as you walk around. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with that idea for that project?
It was a few years ago, actually. I saw a video of the master potters of Korea, the guys that are making the old-style Korean vases and things like that. And it was just a beautiful video with some beautiful natural light streaming through a window and guys just basically creating things with their hands. And I thought, you know, I really want to track down people who are doing things like that. I can probably get you a link to this video later on if I search it out.
Okay, yeah, I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. And so I just sort of decided then and there that, you know, I really wanted to start tracking down people like this. And I knew there was one person I could start with. And so I made contact with him and I made my first portrait, which was a man playing what's called a komungo. It's a Korean traditional instrument. And then from there, I used that to show to a few other people that I'd seen through other photographers or, you know, found online made contact with through other people and just kept showing them this work and saying, hey, would you like to be a part of this? And so far, I haven't had a no. People say, yeah, that's really cool. I'd like to be a part of that. And then they go and introduce you to their friends. And so your network just expands once you get into that little world of people sort of doing that stuff.
I'm sure that you've had plenty of other ideas too for different projects. What was it that made you say, okay, that's the project that I'm going to focus my energy on?
I'm, like a lot of artists, a little bit schizophrenic. I have quite a few different personalities inside, and it's occasionally quite difficult to actually nail down and say, look, I really want to actually pursue this. And this one, I've actually taken quite a big hiatus on this to produce my next project, which you mentioned in the beginning. But this one, it just keeps pulling at me. I think there's something about it. Like I said, you know, with my work, I tend to turn it down if I don't feel it. And that applies to my personal work as well. And this one just seems to keep pulling at me. You know, every now and again, it just pops into my mind. And I've got my list of people I should contact. So I contact one more and do another portrait. It's sort of difficult to dedicate a huge chunk of time to it because of, you know, ongoing commitments, other work. I have to pay the bills. This costs me money to do. So I have to be sort of very careful how much of it and when I do it. But whenever the opportunity does arise, I try and take it and make the best of it.
Speaking of paying the bills, how do you balance that professional work or work that you make money from with your personal projects and the things you do just, you know, for your own self-interest? Do you have, like, would you say, 80% of the time you're doing your business work and the other 20% of the time projects? Do you have some kind of formula, or do you just cut out blocks of time and go for it?
I do my best to make sure I'm at least shooting something for myself every week, whether that just means, you know, carrying my camera as I walk to the supermarket rather than taking the bus, or something like that, just to get my mind going. But the way that the year kind of breaks itself up in Korea is that winter is sort of uninhabitable here, and so a lot of people don't really do much during that time. And so I'm able to travel and do other personal work during that time. And also this summer, there's a couple of weeks where basically the country shuts down and doesn't really do much. So that's a good time to get personal work done as well. So it's not so much a case of breaking it up, but just sort of going with the flow a little bit, I think.
So let's move on now to your project that you just finished or funded. With Kickstarter. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is one of my winter projects. so I usually have January and February bitterly cold, so I usually have a good excuse to get out of Korea, go somewhere warm, and see something new. And actually, if we wind back a little bit, it was last year in the summer. I have a personal love for Myanmar. As I know, you've experienced the place, you know where I'm coming from with this. Just beautiful people,
yes,
and
it's awesome.
Just wonderful light, and it's a beautiful place. And you know, I just finished my busy season of the year, and I was tired. I think I'd worked something like 75 days straight. That's shooting, and so you're wow. You know, you're editing around all of that, and that was a pretty intense time. And I just said, look, to my wife, I said, look, next week I'm going to Myanmar. Is that okay? And so I upped and went for a couple of weeks. I have a very understanding wife.
Good.
And
that's
and
important.
She sort of said, yeah, that's fine. That's very important. That's the key to being successful, is having an understanding partner. and I went to a little town called Mrau, which had actually been closed when I first visited due to what you might call civil war, a little bit of unrest. This time it was open, and so I thought, well, let's go up there. Not a lot of tourists go there. I can relax for a little bit. And I ended up meeting a guy up there who was a tour guide, and he said, look, you know, you're up here. You're only up here once. You have to come and, you know, see these people. And so I went with him to meet these tattoo-faced ladies that are sort of advertised all around the town. And I wasn't thinking much of it. I was thinking it might be a little bit like a, you know, a human zoo that you find in certain parts of the world. But we can try not to make it that way ourselves. And so I went up the river with him and got introduced to a few of these ladies and really, really liked what they had to say. They were sharing a lot more than I expected. You know, it was a very deep conversation. They were telling me about their histories and their beliefs and things like that. And as I was parting my last little village that I stayed in, the village chief actually said to me, I hope that you'll come back sometime. And that sort of sealed it. I mean, I was already thinking about it. But,
you know. Do you think you really meant it? Like, you know, sometimes people say that, and not that they wouldn't want you back
at the
there,
time.
But,
I'd like
know,
to
sometimes
think
people are like, "Yeah, come on back."
Right. Yeah. No. Absolutely. It could have been just parting words, but you know, I already had it in my head that I wanted to go back, so I started making plans, you know, as I was on the flight out of Myanmar. My things I was going to tell my wife and excuses I was going to make to be able to. To spend a whole lot of our money and go and do a project that I wanted to do. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so that sort of built into me planning this second phase of the project, which was to go back and go a lot deeper, visit a lot more villages, visit a lot more people, hear a lot more stories, and try to put something together that would sort of form a bit of a history for these people.
You said it's in Mrauk U is the name of the place?
Right, Mrauk U. So the K is silent on that? Yeah, Mrauk U.
And then how did you decide to go there? You had said there was like some problems up there or something. Or how did you say, I'm going to go to that place? Because I don't think that's on the main tourist triangle or trail that they have there.
Right. No, it's definitely not. But it's a beautiful place. It's sort of secluded on the west coast in Rakhine State. It's a little river city, a lot of history. It was where the Rakhine Kings were originally based. It was a British trading town at one point as well. It's a beautiful little place, but it's quite difficult to get to, especially at the moment. They're currently building a highway, which actually may be done now. You might be able to take a bus there. But up until now, it's been practically impossible with any sort of time constraint to actually get up there. It takes a good 2 days of flying and boats to get there, or 48 hours on buses through terrible roads. Mm-hmm. So the highway may be finished and it might be a little bit simpler to get there now, which will really expand their tourism. But I think mostly because, you know, you get 28 days in Myanmar on your visa, and most people will do the tourist triangle of Yangon, Bagan, and then Inle Lake, and then maybe Mandalay, and head back to Yangon and fly out. I mean, those places are absolutely beautiful. There's no need to spend any less time in those.
So, when you left, the first time and you're on the flight back, mm-hmm. and you're thinking about your project, what was mm-hmm. your, goal for the second round, or what did you conceive in your head of, you know, this is going to be what, you know, to do the book or focus on whatever mm-hmm. areas and whatnot? How did you, what was your goal?
Right. So, I mean, it was a little bit different to what it actually became. My tour guide, when I spoke to him, said that he knew of approximately 50 of these tattoo-faced ladies that were remaining and that we could probably visit them all. And interview them. And I thought, okay, great. So we'll make this a book of portraits with some interviews, some sort of extended interviews, and turn it into just a record of what they had to say. And then when I thought, you know, I'll make that into a book and I'll do an exhibition with it. That was sort of my goal with that, not really knowing how much work that was and what it would take to get there at the time. But then I booked all my flights and I went back over there, and it was actually on the very first day of traveling the river, we stopped in a little, well, not so little village of about 100 or so houses, and we thought, you know, oh, great, lunchtime. Nobody had really sort of told us anything. We've been on a boat for 4 hours. This is myself and the videographer. We got off. We're like, oh, great, it's lunchtime. We'll, you know, we'll get something to eat, and then we'll move on to our destination. And we sat down at one of the houses, and then after about 5 minutes or so, there were about 20 of these tattooed ladies sitting around us in a circle at this house. And so we're already halfway pretty much to what my guide had said, you know, of the remaining people in this tribe. Mm-hmm. And so that was quite a surprise. And that sort of said to me, well, actually, there's going to be a lot more than we thought. And so I started rethinking the goal of the project into not so much just being a series of portraits, but actually taking the history that they were saying, the things they were telling me, and sort of trying to recreate a little bit of that in photography and tell those stories for their grandchildren and also for the tourists visiting, so that they would get a little bit of a deeper look into into the people that live in the area.
Once you got there, then you, what did you do as far as, you know, photographing them is concerned? Can you talk a little bit about the process that you decided to use to photograph them?
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, I wanted to make almost studio portraits of these people. The original goal of making these portraits with I made a lot of them with a black background. The reason for that in the beginning was I wanted you to see individual faces. I didn't want you to, you know, look at pretty lady in the pretty village and sort of make it sort of a this person in this space, giving you that sort of quick snapshot of what life is like and allowing you to make up your own ideas about it. I wanted you to focus specifically on their face and see every single individual and every little detail of their faces that made them different. So I made some really tightly cropped portraits on black backgrounds for that reason. The reason also that I decided to use flash in this was to create a little bit of a juxtaposition with the content of the photos. So I'm photographing something that probably existed 50 to 60 years ago. Things may have looked the way that I photographed them with my environmental portrait, but by adding flash to that, I was able to give it a bit of a modern edge. So you had this sort of juxtaposition with the technology used to create a photograph of a very, very old scene.
What was the reaction of the people that you photographed? Like, while you were taking their picture, were they shy? Were they, you know, compliant? Or they do, you know, pose for you as you ask them? How were they in front of the camera?
So I think, you know, people are people, right? They're, you get different reactions from every single person you talk to. I remember on about the third day, I was photographing a lady who just decided she was going to break out in a dance in the middle of the session. it really didn't, you know, it was nothing to do with what we were trying to photograph. She just, that was what she wanted to do. And so we had a few, you know, varying reactions from people. Some people were shy. Some people sort of tried to pose themselves. Like, but a lot of these people were quite in awe of the equipment that was there. I mean, sure, people have seen cameras and things this far out, but nobody had really seen a softbox on a light stand before, and these sort of remotely controlled flashes that were going off and lighting them up. And they were a little confused as to how I was able to change the shape of the light and things. So you have this beautiful scene in the forest, and all of a sudden they're on a black background, you know? That was quite confusing for a lot of them. But, you know, people were mostly quite open to it. And of course, you know, I spent time with them before I photographed them. It wasn't sort of walk into the village without pointing my camera at people. Cameras were away in bags every time we arrived in a village. And it was more of a case to sit down, get to know people, introduce ourselves and the project that I was working on, and then start the photography process. So I think that made it a little bit easier for people to accept the fact that there was a lot of, you know, equipment being set up in their villages.
So this was the second time you've been to that area, but for many of the people, it was the first time that you had ever met them.
Yeah. So when you visit Brau U, there's a limit. Myanmar has these limited tourist zones that will hopefully start breaking down with the new government, but there's these limited areas that you can go to. And if you try and stray outside of those, you might be stopped or arrested, you know, depending on who's there at the time. And so the first visit, I actually only went to a couple of villages, and that was sort of within the tourist circuit, except for one of them, which I had to get special permission to go to. But this time around, I was actually straying way outside of the tourism area. So we needed special guidance and special permissions to go and do it. And so these people most likely haven't seen very many foreign people. In fact, one of the villages we were at had told us that the very first time they had seen a foreign person in their village, in anybody's memory, was a week prior when an NGO came down to donate some solar panels for them.
Jeez.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's pretty remote areas that we were visiting. So if they hadn't seen any of this equipment before, it's not particularly common. in self-sustaining villages.
And you said you hired a guide or a fixer. Is somebody just kind of walked up to you and said, hey, do you want to see this area? I mean, can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, how did you get into that area? And did you hire a fixer or guide? How did that work out?
Okay, so on the first time around, I was actually, I'd been playing football with some kids in a field. And I was just sort of sitting down getting a drink of water, and I hear this voice behind me saying, excuse me, sir, are you enjoying Rau? I thought, wow, you know, this is a city where even the hoteliers don't speak any English, and I'm hearing perfect English. So I turned around and I said hello to the man, and he sat down, and we talked a little bit. And it turned out that, you know, he was a tour guide. Of course, it was summer, so he really didn't have a lot to do. There's no tourists. There were four tourists in the city at the time. Four. And so he really didn't have a lot to do. And so he was looking for a little bit of extra work, but also just to have somebody to talk to and speak some English with and all of that. And it turned out he was just a really nice guy. And he helped out a lot with taking me out there and translating. And so I kept in contact with him, and you know, I actually went down to his house and had dinner with his wife and his parents and his parents-in-law. And then you know, we kept in touch, and we organized the second trip together, and he put me in touch with other people who could get us out of the area that we were restricted to. And so I guess after that, he stopped being a guide and became more of a fixer. He was sort of making everything happen on the ground before I got there, and with people that obviously, you know, without language, I couldn't speak to. So that's sort of how I pulled the project together and made it all happen. Definitely couldn't have done it on my own.
Okay. So let's kind of change gears a little bit and talk about Kickstarter and how you funded this project using that platform. So you created the book. Your idea was to create a book. How did Kickstarter come into this and say, oh, what if I raise money on Kickstarter? How did you get that idea?
Basically, you know, I wanted to self-publish this so I could have complete control over, you know, where it was distributed, where the funds would go, and things like that. And publishing a book, it turns out, is a little bit more expensive than you'd think it was. You actually need quite a bit of money. So I decided, you know, why don't we look at different funding platforms and see what's possible. And I ended up choosing Kickstarter because of its... A lot of the platforms like Indiegogo or something like that, they have this flexible funding option where you can, you know, get funded fully, or you can get funded to a certain point, but they'll still give you the money. Whereas Kickstarter, if you don't make it to your goal, you get nothing. Nobody's card gets charged, and you don't get a thing. So I thought that would really push me to make it as big as I actually wanted it to be. And so we picked Kickstarter and, you know, spent a month or so just researching what this was going to cost and finding the people to actually do the printing and deciding on how I was going to promote it and what else would be needed just to make sure it got in front of people, you know?
How long was the campaign? It lasted a month?
It's a month, yeah. Kickstarter recommends you do a month, no more, no less. I don't think they actually do less than a month, to be honest, but if you do more, they say that. And once you start doing the campaign, you sort of understand why they say that. But if you do more, it gives people who are thinking about backing it a little bit more chance to sort of back out. There's not a sense of urgency. So you do the 30 days, and then it also gives you a lot of urgency, but it also gives people who want to back that sort of urgency. You know, if they don't think, oh, I've got a month and a half, I can, you know, do it later, and then they forget about it, you know? Whereas if you have 30 days, people sort of feel like they have to fund it now. But it becomes a full-time job when you run this thing. I think that's one of the main reasons Kickstarter says only really do 30 days, because if you were to do 2 months of your life, it would be 2 months of your life staring at a monitor and trying to figure out how to make people give you money on Kickstarter. So, I mean, it comes down to that. It's basically you have to get it in front of people in order for them to fund you, and it's tough.
Well, Speaking of getting people to give you money, you got 160 backers to pledge almost 23,000 Australian dollars, which is about $17,000. What were the keys to making that campaign successful?
Kickstarter themselves will tell you this as well, but I think I found it out along the way. Leveraging your existing networks is a great way to build momentum. And so basically I contacted everybody I knew, I let them know it was going to happen, and I made an email sign up form, said, you know, guys, put your emails in here, that way I can let you know, you know, just in case anybody that I knew on Facebook had a different email address from what they used to have or something like that, just so that I knew I had a point of contact for everybody. And I got in touch with all of them personally, and I ran an exhibition to sort of get a bit of momentum in my local community, and, you know, just consistent social networking. So a couple of posts a day on Instagram, posts a day on Facebook, just constantly letting people know, to the point where it probably became pretty noisy after the first week or two.
You told me earlier you sent out a bunch of emails.
Quite a few, yeah.
you got published in the South China Morning Post, is it called?
Yep.
The newspaper in Hong Kong, I think. Like, did you? So you approached other press and stuff like that. How did How did you go about that? Did you make a list, or just how did you get their emails and so on?
Yeah, I did. Like, I went around and I looked up, you know, editors for certain things. You know, Huffington Post and all of these online newspapers, and, you know, sort of your New York Times blog and all of that. And I pitched it out there to a lot of the emails that I'd found on their sites, and a few of them got back to me, and I did end up getting published on the South China Morning Post and in a couple of local things here in Korea. I actually had Huffington Post get back to me after the campaign ended. thanks, guys. So you can edit that out if you like. Okay. I did have Huffington Post get back to me after the campaign.
It's ended. Their it loss.
Exactly. And it was a completely different person to who I actually contacted. So I think they must have found it and got in contact with me through the Kickstarter itself, which is great. And a good portion that we got featured by Design Indaba and Momentum Travel. And these guys all actually found me through Kickstarter. So once the Kickstarter starts, people sort of get an interest in what you're doing, and you get these messages through Kickstarter saying, hey, would you like to send us a few images and maybe a little bit, answer a few questions for us? We'd love to feature you. And I mean, that's the best thing anybody could do for you, is put it in front of their audience, you know?
Where do the proceeds go? What do you do with the money?
So what we're doing with it is basically covering the costs of printing the book and shipping it over to Myanmar. So there is the whole goal with this was a zero profit. Just I really want to create something that's kind of cool and leaves a bit of a change in the world. And so there's zero profit to this. And that's another reason for doing the Kickstarter, is that I really wanted to fund the publication of the book so that I wouldn't have to recoup my costs, basically. I'd be able to donate this, have it sold, and use that to raise money to be able to help these people. Next step is to get the book printed, have a meeting about that in a couple of days' time, and then actually this Saturday we're going down to work with the printer on doing our final test sheets before we do the run. And then from there it'll be a couple of weeks and we start shipping them out to all of our backers on Kickstarter. And then I'll be shipping a box full to Myanmar, where they'll be in a bookstore in Yangon and a couple of hotels in Rau. And my guides from this trip will actually be selling them to anybody who visits and would like to get a copy of it, and collecting that cash for us so that we're able to then hopefully work with a couple of existing institutions that will be able to do good in these villages.
So once the books in Myanmar are sold, then that money will go back to be reinvested into other initiatives to help out the community there.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. So,
and how have you found the, I would imagine they're like NGOs or volunteer organizations. Have you contacted with any of them yet, or do you have any in mind? What's your plan for that?
Yeah, I'm in conversation with a couple at the moment. Won't sort of say who yet until we decide who we're going to work with and all of that. But the ideas have been positive, and I'm working with a group of people at the moment talking about the best way to provide a self-sustaining education system for the remote villages. And the second thing that we wanted to help out with was clean water. So I've got a list of a few people that I'm talking to at the moment, and we're just trying to find somebody who's sort of on the same page with doing a lot of good, but not wanting a lot back. And that's sort of tough, you know, when you're working with NGOs, they have a lot of people on their payroll. You know, obviously everybody has to make a living. And so a lot of the money that goes into things like that ends up being used to pay the people who go to do it and not for doing a lot of good. So I'm trying to work with people who not really don't have high overheads, if you know what I mean. Yeah. So it's tough to find them, but we're working on it.
Do you have any tips for people who are thinking about starting their own project on Kickstarter?
Be prepared.
Prepared to do a lot of work.
Be prepared to do a lot of work, but also be prepared in terms of, you know, have a plan for what you're going to do. Don't start this Kickstarter and think it's going to take care of itself. It's not. You really have to be on it every day, reminding people that it's there, asking people to share it for you, putting it in front of people who may not have seen it before. And you need a plan to do that, because if you wake up and over breakfast you're trying to decide what you're going to do, you'll never get anything done. And so I think a good couple of months before you actually launch, which is what I did, of just compiling lists of people you want to contact and deciding, you know, what you want to have done in the first week, what you want to have done in the second week, and where you want it to be, who you want it to be in front of, finding new people to put it in front of, all of that stuff. If you try and do that within the 30-day period that you have on Kickstarter, you're going to fail. And it happens a lot, and Kickstarter actually sends you sort of a warning thing, you know, saying, look, you really need to be prepared for this sort of thing, you know. Not so much of a warning, but a sort of a guide that you really need to be prepared, or it's just not going to happen. So that would be my advice, is to really compile a list of everybody you want to put it in front of, when you're going to contact them, find out how you're going to do that, and then, you know, also do a few things during the Kickstarter to keep momentum. On the day before the launch, or on the day of the launch, we actually held an exhibition in Seoul. And what that meant was that I had 60 or 70 people come who I got to present my project to. And we also got an extra piece of promotional material. So we made a video of the evening, and that was our update to our backers on the second day. Like, hey, here's how we're doing. This is what we did last night here in Seoul. Great reception. People are loving it. We'd love your support. So we were able to keep the momentum going like that as well.
How did you choose the place to do your exhibition? Was it like in a cafe, or was it like a exhibition center? Did you ask for, you know, some help? A lot of times whenever you want to exhibit in places, they ask for money. I mean, how can you tell us a little bit about that process of exhibiting, of starting that first kind of exhibit party?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I decided not to do it as a long-term thing, because I knew that during the course of the Kickstarter, I'd be really busy and I really wouldn't be able to sort of be going into this exhibition center every day and talking to people and things like that. So what I decided to do was just to do a one-day exhibition that would involve, you know, a casual finger food dinner, some wine, a presentation about it, and, you know, some photos on the wall, and just a little bit of, you know, networking with the people who were there, catching up with people I hadn't seen for a while and letting them know about the project. It was a great chance for me to also bring a lot of my clients together, you know, people that I've worked with in the past, people like Volvo Korea, people like the Australian Embassy, and just bring them out, show them, hey, this is what I've been doing. You know, I don't just do what I do with you guys. This is actually another part of my passion for photography. And you know, quite a few people were quite surprised that that's, you know, what I do outside of my business. You know, a lot of people play the piano on the weekend, and I just keep taking pictures, you know. So they were quite surprised at what I was doing, but it was a great format, I think. It was very informal, and it was just more of a networking session and a, hey, this is what I'm doing sort of thing, rather than a formal exhibition. But I think that it suits my personal style a little bit more as well. I'm not a particularly formal person, so.
One thing I heard was that in order to make a Kickstarter successful, you have to give really good rewards or different types of rewards. And I thought yours were really interesting. They started from the lowest one was, I think, for $10, and you could get some mm-hmm. postcards. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And yep. then the highest one was, I think, for $2,000 and two backers to go on a tour with you. Mm-hmm. to the village. Mm-hmm. How did you, in which, by the way, I think I saw both of the tour
we ones were filled. Yep, which is wonderful. I'm actually talking to those two guys right now, trying to organize exactly when we're going to do it and what we're going to be doing. So it's pretty exciting.
How did you come up with those, all the different rewards in the reward system? Was there any thought or strategy behind that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the goal of the project was to create the book. And I realized that the way I wanted to create it, which would be a beautiful, big, hardcover coffee table book, wasn't really a practical idea for, say, a tourist going backpacking in Myanmar to pick up and take home. Nobody's going to carry that around for the remaining 2 months of their journey or something as they go through Southeast Asia, you know? So I thought, well, why don't we create a soft cover small book as well? And so that became two rewards in and of itself. But I'd planned this a little bit before we went as well, and I actually asked one of the tattooed ladies to weave some scarves for us. The area is quite well known for its weaving, and I thought that would be a really cool personal touch to add to this, is to actually have one of the women from the book weave scarves to put in a special edition of the book. And so that became the box set that you see on the site. We also did postcards because I think, you know, not everybody, especially people who don't know you, are willing to contribute $50, $60, $70. So we needed something for somebody who, or maybe just didn't want to spend the postage on shipping a hardcover book around the world, you know. It's not cheap to do. So there's cheaper rewards for people who might want to contribute a smaller amount. And then I thought, you know, everybody that I was speaking to in the lead up to running the campaign was like, wow, this is, you know, it's pretty cool. Like, what did it take to get out there? And I just thought, well, I'll show you. And that's where our tour reward came from, because I thought, you know, people would actually want to go and do this, but also do it with, you know, a photographic guide as well, somebody who's able to improve their photography along the way. And so that's where that idea was born.
And you've also led tours before in Southeast Asia, and you do mm-hmm. workshops as well in Korea. So that's great.
Mm-hmm. It's not going to be a formal workshop as such, but it will be more of a personalized. We're doing it one-on-one, so it'll be more of a personalized sort of guide and helping you through what you hope to get out of it, rather than me sort of lecturing at somebody. It will be more of an organic tour, so it's going to be a lot of fun, I think.
If people want to continue to support the project, mm-hmm. the Kickstarter campaign is over, so you can't donate money or whatever anymore. Mm-hmm. Is there any way that people can continue to support what you're doing?
Yeah. If you're in Myanmar, there's a few places you can pick it up in Rau. Or I will actually have it. It's up on my website at the moment, in my store. We're not fulfilling orders just yet because we don't have the books in hand. That'll be another couple of weeks. But I can give you that link for the show notes as well. And if you want to go over there and make a pre-order or wait until the book is actually out, you can get a copy from there.
One last thing. You said somewhere throughout the promotion of this project, time and time again, I have heard the same words uttered. I'm so envious of what you are doing, and I wish I could do something like this. These words bug me every time I hear them. those were your words. But I can imagine, because actually I wanted to do this interview with you because I said, when I saw your project, I said, man, that's awesome. And it's an alternative way to, you know, using Kickstarter. It's just another way to make projects happen without having to get the support of some companies or backers or whatever else. So yeah, that was actually something that I thought. I'm envious and wow, I want to do the same thing. And I'm sure hundreds of other people or many others I want to do the same. So what would you say to those people?
I have said it to quite a few people. I mean, I've had random people that I don't know contact me on Facebook and just say, look, man, I'm so envious of what you've been able to do, and I wish I could do something like that. And I think it comes down to the same thing as starting your own business. And Pete, you know about this. I mean, you've just started your own business. It really comes down to making a decision. Everything that we do in life is a decision. If you decide that you're going to, you know, work 5 days a week and spend your wages on going to the pub on Friday and Saturday nights, then that was your decision. You're not going to be able to do something outside of that. If you decide you're going to live like a hermit and spend that same money on traveling, then you're going to be able to do that. I've set myself up over this time, you know, working for myself was a decision that I made because I wanted more time to work on things that I was passionate about. And that gave me the freedom to be able to make that next step, which is to create something a little bit bigger. And I also married a pretty amazing woman who lets me go and do all this stuff. So that's another step. Marry my wife, you know? but I mean, really, it all comes down to the decisions you make. I mean, you know, if you decide that a career is really important to you, then that's sort of going to become what you do. If you decide that that working for yourself and, you know, only working the bare minimum to sort of get yourself out to these other situations, then that's sort of what's going to happen for you. So it's all around what we decide to do, I think. I don't think that envy really helps us get anywhere. It's making the decision to just go and do something that helps us get there. I mean, we live in the first world. Most people that we're talking to now are going to be hearing this in the first world. And I think that in the first world, you have opportunities that nobody else, you know, people in these villages that I was visiting don't have a school. They don't have a way to make money. They don't even have clean drinking water. I think you have a lot more options than they do. And I think that, you know, understanding that you have options and decisions that can influence what you're able to do and what you want to do. Once you understand that, it becomes a lot easier to just sort of cut ties with the things that don't really matter to you and work on the things that do.
Very well said.
That's a tough one, and it's hard to do. It's really hard to do.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm still trying to figure out how to be a hermit and go to the pub at the same time.
Well, you live in a place where it's a little bit cheaper to go to the pub than it is here. Yeah.
Is there any final words that you'd like to say to our audience?
I think yes. Let's string it from that. Let's say, you know, create. Work at something until you're happy with it. Move on, create something else. Just keep that cycle going. That's the way to create, I think. It's just to keep doing it and doing it and getting better and better and working on projects that mean something to you.
Perfect. Where can people find you?
You can find me at dylangoldby.com. You might want to click that in the show notes. Welkinlight.com. And you can find me on Facebook at Welkin Light Photography. You can also find me on Instagram at Welkin Light.
You're on Twitter as well, right?
I have a Twitter. I don't use it. It tweets things automatically for me. So finding me on Twitter is probably not the best way to...
Well, some of the articles I found from you were... when I did the Google search, they came up with as your Twitter post. So those Twitter feeds or posts are actually easier to find, I think, are showing up in the search results more than, say, some other stuff. So, yeah, I was curious whether or not you were using it. I didn't know it was automated, but that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. No. Marketing 101 from Pete.
Yes.
use Twitter. Actually, use Twitter.
Well, that's what I was saying. Not many photographers, I think, use Twitter. It's usually Instagram or something else. But I said, this is interesting. A lot of your stuff is showing up on Twitter before anything else. So, yeah, something to think about.
Interesting.
So. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Not at all. Thank you, Pete.